Hello, hello, and welcome to the Thin Blue Mind. Each week we will be looking at current policing issues and topics within the UK. Our regular panel consists of Steve Bradshaw, who is a TV and theatre actor, Richard Horton, author, and me, Dave Thomas, broadcaster. What we all have in common is over 80 years of combined police service. Now retired, we will be providing opinion and insights from the unique position of having been there and done it. Steve spent the majority of his service on firearms before being promoted to inspector, where he was a force incident manager. Richard was a career detective before going back into uniform as a response sergeant. Myself, I spent the majority of my service on the roads policing unit before going into CID and child protection. You may not agree with everything we say, but we will make you think.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion.
Well, hello, hello, and welcome to this week's episode of The Thin Blue Mind. Now, our very own Steve Bradshaw is recently starred in, what's it called?
The Confession.
And it gives us a little bit of context, really, about what we're going to be talking about today. So, Steve, just tell us a little bit about the... Is it a documentary? Is that what they call them?
It's a real crime drama, I think you call it. It's part of a series on Amazon Prime. Effectively, it's called The Confession, and it centres around the real story of a lady called Patricia Hall, who suddenly one day in January 1992 vanished from her home in Yorkshire. And it details the subsequent inquiry from there. And it's quite good. It's quite unique. It actually features the real people involved. And it has like a drama set behind it where it reenacts some of the things that happen. And I actually play Detective Superintendent Jim Bancroft in it. And it was quite eye-opening as a cop I was at the time when I filmed it, actually going through the investigation process and reenacting it and thinking to yourself like how things would have changed now and what would we do different. The main suspect at the time was the husband, Keith Hall, and effectively there's no evidence against him. She just disappeared. So very quickly, the investigation that was being spearheaded by Jim Bancroft came to a dead end. A bit of time later, I think it was a few months, the investigating officers were contacted by a lady who had responded to a Lonely Hearts article in the local newspaper, and it was from Keith Hall. This lady, having seen the local press coverage from it, had approached the detectives and said, "I've had contact from this Keith Hall. I'm thinking of writing back," because this is before, you know, online dating. So yeah, she actually put pen to paper, and she came to the police and said, "What shall I do?" So it was Jim Bancroft's decision at that point is to take over that role. And we do go through this and we reenact this in the drama, where we get the lady involved to write back and initiate that contact. And then the police take over that contact and subsequently put in a female officer to effectively go out with him. And that itself now, with recent rule changes regarding undercover work and what you can and can't do, and the legislation and internal processes around how we deal with covert officers, obviously, would be different from 1992. So this female officer strikes up a conversation and, you know, we reenact some of the surveillance, and you can imagine the technology from early 90s. What's actually good is it shows the police officers and the investigation team and Jim Bancroft, they walked a line with Pace about entrapment, should I say? But it's like, well, what's the end goal here? And obviously the end goal was to try and get him to talk about his wife and what happened. It goes into those conversations that they had, how things were led, and how maybe certain things were put on the tables sexually, conditions.
The honey trap.
Exactly. You know, certain things were said by Keith and, you know, which could lead to a charge for the disappearance of Patricia and how that went down in court.
Well, it's an interesting case, isn't it? And just set the context for today's discussion. We're talking about the Police and Criminal Evidence Act 1984.
basically the rule book that the police use and guides them in everything that they do. It was brought in following recommendations set out by the Royal Commission on Criminal Procedures, and it was there to unify police powers under one code of practice and to carefully balance the rights of the individual against the powers of the police. Pace-mandated audio recording of all suspect interviews, the right to legal representation for suspects, and limits on detention before charge. Pace resulted from growing judicial and public criticism of the police conduct when dealing with suspects, most notably arising from the mid-1970s cases of the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four, whose confessions formed the basis of cases against them, and which were later found to have been coerced by physical and psychological abuse. And perhaps maybe we'll talk about those cases a bit later. Eventually, their convictions were quashed. The reforms were born of the fact that the system didn't want to accept that the police misbehaved in such cases, because first of all, that would mean that you couldn't trust the police, and secondly, it would mean that the real offenders were still out there. So there are codes of practice that accompany the Act. The Secretary of State is under an obligation to issue the codes of practice. Currently, they are 8 in number. They cover all sorts of things regarding police activity. So I suppose the question is about PACE and the breaches of PACE. Is finding the truth or evidence at any cost acceptable?
Well, you've got to ask yourself, were we actually finding the truth? Now, none of us are from a pre-PACE era. Yeah. I'm looking for nods, no. So, you know, we've all heard the stories, haven't we, about people being left in cells for the weekend and come back on Monday and soften people up. And, you know, we want the truth rather than a confession, don't we? And I think a lot of the time is one-track mind, somebody's guilty, and we just need to get the confession out of them.
I've always felt while I was in my detective part of my career that I would much rather have good physical evidence that you can put on a table or you can explain to a jury than any amount of confession. As my career went on, the confessions become less and less important. There's more and more no-comment interviews, because if you're advising a client, there may be very limited circumstances where it's in their advantage to talk to the police and explain themselves in the interview. But in most cases, I think there's very little a suspect can do to improve their position by talking or engaging with us. So the safe bet is just go no comment. Confessions, yeah, used to be a big thing, and it used to be a thing, verbaling people or fitting them up, because there'd be a written confession or a written record of the interview signed, but that could have any bloody thing in it. And proved in some cases, which we've alluded to already, to have any bloody thing in it. Tape recording was a good idea. Video recording is not a bad idea either, don't mind that. I don't really mind which way the interview's recorded. I never have done. But I don't place a huge lot of weight in the interview, of a confession from the interview, rather. Some ways I'd rather have a nice, comprehensive, no-comment interview where you walled off all the opportunities to comment, to explain themselves, and leave it at that.
I must admit, certainly for the more complex cases, or serious cases, an interview has never pushed the job into finding of guilt. It was always the evidence supporting the circumstances.
Yeah, if somebody's going to talk, you're going to let them. I had one where there was, I'll take you to where the clothes and the weapon are.
Thank you very much.
You know, yep, we'll have that. Just keep talking, keep telling. Yes, we'll send you out with a support unit and they can walk up the bank of the canal, and sure enough, it was right. So if they're going to talk, let them talk. But I've always much rather have the hammer, the car that didn't burn out on the armed robbery, but if we left the forensics inside it, DNA, all that good stuff that we can show to her, you know, telephone analysis, ANPR cameras, CCTV, much better than a confession. I mean, you could see a lot of those things I've mentioned are things which weren't available to police officers investigating back in the 70s and the 80s. So perhaps a confession was more important back then because you had less supporting evidence available to you, and the temptation to put your hand on the pans of the scale of justice. You know, noble cause corruption, I think, is one of the horrible phrases used for it, but that was the phrase used. Yeah, let's verbal them. They've done it. I'm sure they've done it.
If they've not done this, they've done something else. It was that old chestnut as well.
Absolutely.
Wasn't it?
That, yeah.
But again, this is just hearsay and folklore. I think a lot of us have kind of grown up with in our policing careers, haven't we, about this is the sort of stuff that actually happened. Well, did it? There might be three or four cases nationwide or from certain, shall we say, squads in metropolitan forces, and it's easy to tar everybody with the same brush, isn't it? And people might have fallen back on the fact that he's definitely done it, so we can blur the lines or walk a certain kind of line with it. I'll have that, where he might have considered it, but it probably wasn't as rife as...
It must have been a difficult transition period. I will bet my next coffee, such a superintendent you play on the film, will have operated pre-pace and post-pace. Will have been working on the judges' rules and the way that things were done then. And how hard is it going to be not to blur the lines or not, you know, to have a clear view of pace when you've had your whole career, perhaps?
There's nothing to suggest in the film that Jim Bancroft was corrupt or fitting people up. I just think they were walking a certain evidential line in securing the evidence that they wanted, which I think is a bit different, isn't it?
It's always that way with new legislation, particularly when it's codes of practice stuff and guidance stuff as well, that's built on top of legislation, that there's a period when the courts and the lawyers have to work out what it means, how far can it actually be pushed? Is this still within the boundary? Or when it comes to that, the acid test of somebody's gripping the rail at the Old Bailey or whatever, no, it's wanting, you went beyond. You're never really sure whether the ground is settled under your feet until you've had that test, particularly if you're walking the line and you're thinking, I think it probably extends to encompass this thing that I want to do.
Because it's case law that firms up the legislation, doesn't it?
Absolutely it is, yeah.
And however much nailed on the wording you may think it is when it's enacted, certain musts, shoulds, coulds, and you know, must reasonably expect, these sort of phrases get tested, don't they?
They do.
Interpreted, especially the advancing technology and stuff. The thing I will say is, can we draw some parallels between the early 80s policing and today? Early 80s policing, like you say, the reasons why pace came in, Dave, were for some high profile cases. Some questions that were being asked by MPs, legislative arms, the public themselves, and police officers themselves as well, about, do things need to change? Are current cultural, procedural roles of the police and the way that the police act being questioned? Do things need to change? The Police and Criminal Evidence Act is 40 years of age now. It'll be 40 years of age from when it was being conceived and being written. Very comprehensive, multifaceted piece of legislation which fundamentally changed the way policing worked and police officers did things. Are we at that stage again now, 40 years later?
I'd be really, really careful of that. And the two that spring to mind on reforms that were done to policing, not within Police and Criminal Evidence Act, but as sweeping in their way, the National Crime Recording Standard, yeah, which we're now inspected against, a wonderful idea where a Home Secretary thought that the police were cuffing crime, that it was disproportionately affecting minority communities, and so I'm going to put a system in place that means the police have to record everything. And then HMIC, FRS, the Majesty Inspectorate, started inspecting how well we were recording crimes and found that we were awful and started saying that, you know, you're going to be on special measures because you're not cuffing thousands of crimes. And you're now having police and crime commissioners and chief constables saying the burden of having to record everything according to this standard is getting in the way of business. So that's the first thing. It's a good idea, but it went terribly wrong. The second, and I go back to Theresa May, was there was a feeling abroad within politics that it was unconscionable that people were being left on bail for long periods of time. So there's a whole load of reform of bail, and that's not going south again. But the people were just then released under investigation. It didn't allow us in some cases to put proper bail conditions on dangerous people, the suspects, there's good evidence against them, and we needed to put protective bail conditions on them. It made it very difficult, more difficult for that to happen. So again, there's a sort of wave of public opinion, people being left to rot on bail, let's change it all. Oh, it hasn't worked very well. Oh, well, perhaps we shouldn't have changed it. Perhaps we need to put it back to near what it was. And then, oh, the police are cuffing crime, lots of crime. Right, we'll change that as well. And you end up with a system that is so comprehensive and all-encompassing that it gets in the way of actual business. We're recording every possible crime. The evidence from police and crime commissioners, from chief constables, is that administrative burden, now that it's being properly inspected as well, is more than many forces can bear.
Are you saying that pace is getting in the way of police doing
the
job?
I'm saying is, when you looked at pace, and there's been various revisions to the codes, there's been additional codes of practice put to it, it is regularly reviewed. Whether you want to do something root and branch with pace, I'm not convinced. I think you leave it to evolve in the face of case law. The Secretary of State issues new or revised codes of practice to pace. You perhaps have some amending legislation where there's some real howler comes up, but whether it needs doing root and branch, I'm not convinced.
Well, essentially, the University of Exeter did a research study from 1970 to present day, looking at miscarriages of justice, and they found there was 346 in that period. And they broke it down, so 41% of those was unreliable witness testimonies, 26% was false or unreliable confessions, 22% was false or misleading forensic science, which is an interesting one, isn't it? Because the science is the science. It's the interpretation of it, I suppose, is where that falls down. And 21% was inadequate disclosure. And these are all covered by PACE procedures and policies. And it's worth remembering that a breach of PACE is not a criminal act. So if a police officer does breach PACE, they're not committing an offence. However, as we have seen, it can be terminal to the prosecution.
I think a change that has been made is a policy change. I think now if you were initiating a homicide investigation that was going to be complex and involve the use of undercover officers potentially, you would get a senior Crown Prosecutor on board at an early stage. And you'd be looking to dovetail in with them to make sure that your view of what PACE said you could do and their view of what they could get through a court was in accordance. And I've known that happen in various cases. I did a missing body murder, and from a fairly early stage, there was a senior Crown Prosecutor that was involved, just advising us as we went through. You know, we said we've got this piece of evidence, or we can develop this piece of evidence. And it was just a very useful process.
But that's a change that has come in through testing certain elements of PACE in court, isn't it? To say, well, okay, let's not wait until we get right to the judge's decision.
Oh, yeah.
Let's get an expert in and say, right, let's test it early doors.
Nobody likes surprises, and if you're going to have that bad news on your evidence, it's better to get it before you're at the court door, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay, so is that covered in PACE? This is the point I'm going to make, and I pick up on what you said earlier on about there has been some slight changes that have come along, and people, for whatever reason, and sometimes it's political, a bit of a knee-jerk reaction, and we're responding to the here and now. National Crime Recording Standards, you mentioned about getting CPS involved early doors, yep, early intervention, getting further up the stream and all the rest of it and stuff like that. And Dave, you were saying so many jobs get binned at court. Do we need now to start grabbing all those little bits of legislation or those little bits of policy and political interventions around how we evolve as police? Do we need, like they did in the early 80s, gather them all up and say, right, we need a new rule book, we need a new PACE document or whatever you want to call it, and say, right, this is it now. For the next 30 years, we might have some amendments, but it's 40 years old now. Do we need to kind of scoop everything that's happened since and put it all together and have one rule book that everybody follows and it's in statute?
I'm not sure that PACE is broken.
I'm not saying it's broken, but I'm saying, does it need updates more than what it gets?
Well, I think the most recent update was about 2007, I think, on top of my head, was the introduction of bad character. I think that was a fairly major update. I really can't say whether bad character in a trial has made a difference. I don't know. I mean, you'll never know, will you? That's the jury's decision. But I think that was the last major amendment to the codes.
Yeah, I remember when the caution changed and we got adverse inference. And I talked about the putting the hand on the pan of the scales of justice.
Yeah.
And those are both where it's been said that we should be, things have gone too far in the direction of the suspect. So we get an adverse inference from silence, potentially, which is great, both at the point of injury and the point of charge. We were being ambush-defensed. I think that was what that was about. I didn't have to tell you anything in the interview. And now, on the first day of the court hearing, here's the defence I've had 6 months or a year to think about and cunningly put together. That was certainly happening, and I think the adverse inference was a way of trying to stop that from happening.
Yeah.
And it brings me back to this thing I said, I would rather have all the physical evidence, all the technical and forensic evidence to put before a jury. If there's an exculpatory explanation, and I've had that in interview, where somebody spoke to me and said, actually, if you look at this communication and this communication between me and the complainant, okay, well, look, by George, you're right. Actually, what you said in interview, what you raised in interview, is something the complainant hasn't told us about. It's something we can check and we can look at, and it backs up your version of events really strongly. Yeah, there's an advantage there. But that was an innocent suspect.
I think pace gives us quite a bit of power, actually. There's a lot of things we can do as long as we're... One thing I've learned about pace is it's that it's immutable. You don't break the rules of pace. You break yourself on them. It really is black and white. I had a friend who was never had a complaint in her life or was never investigated. As soon as she went into custody, I think she within the first year, she had 3 investigations against her for breach of pace. Now, whatever reasons you would want to give, any mitigation, it was busy, I had 30 prisoners, I didn't manage to check them all on half-hourly visits. It's irrelevant. Pace says you should, yes. And that's it.
That's something I give thanks for, as I think I managed to avoid during my career. I was never a custody sergeant.
I got my papers to go on the course the week I got back on the ARV as a sergeant, so I was very glad to ring up and cancel that course.
I have nothing but admiration for my colleagues with the sergeant strikes who have done custody sergeant duties, because the whole weight of pace is on your shoulders. And it is it's your responsibility to run that custody unit.
There is a story, I don't know how true it is, so I do give a health warning with this, is that I heard that they were looking at civilianising the custody sergeant's role, and they got some teaming to come in and say, right, how much would we have to pay a member of police staff to do this role? And they looked at it and looked at all the risk that was being carried and all the responsibility. And I think the pay scales were going to be higher than that of a superintendent to pay a police staff officer to do it. So, oh, we'll leave it with the custody sergeant then.
Well, again, I think pace says there's only 2 ranks that are applicable in pace, and that's inspector and superintendent. So there's nothing to stop a custody officer being a civilian. I don't think there's anything in the law to stop them doing it.
There's nothing to stop a constable standing in an emergency, which very early in my service I ended up doing at Darwin for about 2 hours. That is the only time I've served as a custody
We're getting into
officer.
Designated police stations
yes,
now.
All
of
that malarkey, yes.
We could not have foreseen a smartphone. No. In 1982, could we? And the fact that you go to a victim of a rape and you want to take their phone, and obviously the recent issues that we've had about, is it proportionate to be asking to do like phishing trips on people's phones and looking at records and what you can actually get and data off of phone and stuff. Do we need something that scoops up all the guidance? And I go back to College of Police guidance we've discussed before about pace searches. I know it's a Misuse of Drug Act offence, but things like the college are now saying that just the smell of cannabis isn't suitable and all the rest of it. And because we have this guidance here and that guidance there, and then we have the rock that is the pace in the middle of it, and I've said before, if I've got reasonable grounds to search, I will search. I don't care what the college say, and I will search off smell if I want to under the Misuse of Drugs Act. I'm then at conflict with all these other little bits of guidance and legislation that have come out of the ether.
Don't forget the CPIA as well.
Well, yeah. So do we need, are we at a point now, 40 years later, at the point of where public confidence in the policing is so low, does there need to be a reset?
No, I can't think of anything. I thought I'd like to do this as an investigative step. Oh, but pace won't let me.
No.
You just get used to working within what pace allows you to do. I mean, a lot of the cases on pace are you didn't comply with what it says in the law, therefore you've lost the evidence that you have.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, one of my big bugbears, just about the whole process from start to finish, really, is that we don't seem to do case law anymore because CPS are kind of using that guilty, not guilty filter before it gets to court. And obviously that was government-led about getting conviction rates up. But if we're not, if courts aren't deciding case law, then new legislation, I mean, the Road Traffic Act, there's probably more case law on the Road Traffic Act than there is on any other section. There is no situation that hasn't been discussed at some point in case law.
If you look at the evolving breathalyzer form and the number of pages that is at now, most of those pages reflecting, I'm sure, some attempt by somebody to evade the consequences of their drinking actions at court successfully. Yeah. So, yeah, you just keep adding and adding and adding and adding to try and box off every corner for them.
I mean, I'll give you an example. You do a search and you find, I don't know, drugs or a knife, whatever, and the person's arrested. But the search was unlawful. By that, I mean not in policy with pace. And we said it's not a crime to breach pace. And it goes to court. And it transpires that the search wasn't done in policy. Does that case get thrown out? Because at the end of the day, you found a knife. Now, that would be the decision of a judge. But if those cases aren't going to court because CPS go, well, there's been a breach of pace there, we'll probably lose this one. You see what I'm trying to say, can't you?
You can, but that's probably a good pressure back to us, saying, actually, there's a way that you should be doing your searches.
But then it goes back to, there's Billy on the street, I know him well, I know he always carries a knife, I'm going to search him. But Pace says, I don't have any grounds.
It's a slippery slope then, isn't it?
It is a slippery slope.
It's a slippery slope, because then does Billy change his ways, and then Billy gets hung by his ankles every time he comes across a cop car, and he's not been in trouble for 2 years, 3 years.
On the other hand, if you know that Billy habituates that area when he's out and about, and that the last two times he's been stopped, he has had a weapon of some sort on him, that gets you a lot more towards reasonable.
But the example I use is bringing us back to that original question of, is it acceptable to get evidence if you know, with the best intentions, but you're breaching Pace? Pace was brought in. Let's remember, some of these miscarriages of justice, a lot were in the 70s with the IRA, the Birmingham Six, their convictions were quashed. Got a very large payout. There was reports of them being tortured, beaten. One of the guys who had a phobia of dogs, so they put police dogs in the cell and on the point of attack on a long lead and then pulled them back. And to this day now, this guy has got PTSD and he still suffers. And if he sees a dog, he has to walk over on the other side of the pavement. Obviously, we weren't connected with that case and maybe the officers that were might have a different view, but it was horrendous what was done to those people.
One of the good things I've seen happen is on arrests and the test for necessity of the arrest. I don't know if it's happened to you in your career, but early in my career, and we're looking at the Pace has just come in, really, you'd have the command from a sergeant or inspector, arrest them. For what? On what evidence? You would be thinking in your head. And I don't mind, just get them arrested. Get them in custody. And now, with having to explain the necessity for the arrest, it's just another filter to prevent the bad stuff like that happening. And it definitely happened.
But it takes extreme cases like this to force the changes that came around for Pace. Now, us looking back, we would never even dream of there being a system in place where you interviewed somebody and it wasn't recorded. What a ridiculous notion that is.
Well, I think there was a case of Stephen Downing. I think he was murder, I think. Conviction was quashed, but he was interviewed without legal representation and the signed confession was written by a police officer.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of safeguards there, are there?
So we're talking 40 years ago, aren't we? I suppose an extended point that I'll make is, in 40 years' time, there'll be something that policing is doing now, which an officer will go, I can't believe they did that. And does it take something like an amalgamation of a new Pace to cover that? Because you mentioned about CPS thresholds before. That's not in Pace, is it? And it's a massive part of policing, isn't it? It's a massive part of policing nowadays, isn't it? Trying to get something past the CPS. And it's a subjective piece of decision-making by that lawyer that's on the phone.
They're trying to put themselves into the minds of a jury and what would they believe or not believe. And
that's a reform that we have served under, I certainly have.
Well, that's target-driven. There's no other reason for it.
Yeah, the police used to make the charging decisions.
You tell me you're detectives, or we're detectives. Is there something in place that says when a CPS officer of a certain rank or standing needs to be involved in a case of such a threshold, rape, murder, attempt murder, serious assaults?
There's specialist prosecutors, aren't they? So if you have a rape case, it'll go to, you know, the RASO and...
But where's that? Is that some internal local process between an MOU between police and...
You'll find it in the senior investigating officer's policy book that they've made that policy decision that they're going to do it. You'll also find it in the training courses murder manual that it's a thing you might want to consider.
Say you're a detective chief superintendent with a murder and Dave is as well. You would both apply that same test subjectively, wouldn't you? So there's nothing that says at this point you need to involve this ranked person from CPS. There's no standardisation, is there, in relation to that? And that's a massive, massive thing on policing. Again, where's that written down?
Well, the objective test is subjective, isn't it? Is there a reasonable chance that you will get a conviction at court? Well, we don't know unless it goes to court. And that's the whole point with these, when we're making decisions, isn't it? Or the CPS are making decisions. A lot of cases aren't going to court because the victim's unreliable because they've been lying in the past. Well, they've been lying in the past because they've been a victim of sexual abuse for the last 10 years. And there's all sorts of reasons why cases don't go to court. And sometimes we should just say, let the court decide.
That makes my point in many ways, because there will be influences at that moment in that year about that certain kind of offence, whether it be rape or assaults or whatever, about conviction rates in court and all the rest of it, which might sway a CPS person's decision about whether to proceed with the court. What's the current burden on courts and stuff like that? In equal measure weighing delight and dole should be the fact that, well, forget how long the waiting list is for Preston Crown Court or Manchester Crown Court or whatever. That shouldn't influence whether this person is put before a court or not. That's why you need some central legislation to support that.
Occasionally, in a long-running case, you'll get two different lawyers look at the same evidence. And one will say, no, I don't see where we're going with this. The other will say, that's a really good job. Yeah, let's get him charged.
I mean, there are checks and balances, aren't there, in CPS? I mean, I had a traffic case, a fatal, where the reviewing lawyer said there was no further action on it. But then, because of the seriousness of it, went to the senior prosecutor, who disagreed and said, no, there is a job here and we are running it. So there are checks and balances there.
Yeah, but again, what you're highlighting there is an imbalance.
It's like I say, they've become like a pseudo-jury, haven't they? It's a filter.
I suppose if you wanted a test, Police and Criminal Evidence Act is there to ensure that the police use their powers fairly. That's the top and bottom of it, I think. So if there's a public concern that we're not using our powers for fairly in a certain area, and I think probably the examination of digital devices is probably one that's current, and people talk about digital rape and that sort of thing, then there's probably enough there to have some sort of experts, lawmakers and data forensics people, both specialist prosecutors and specialist defence lawyers in the area as well, to be put together and said, well, is there any amendment needed made to PACE or to the guidelines of it? And then if that's a thing, they come back in the report, nope, what we've got's enough, or we need to change the law, or we need to change the guidance. But that should be an ongoing process, I guess, with the Secretary of State keeping it under review and keeping a weather ear out for, are there concerns that the police aren't acting fairly in relation to the gathering of evidence and the treatment of suspects and in what they do? And that gets encoded into PACE. At the end of the day, it's about us acting fairly towards suspects and fairly in the way that we gather evidence.
Well, and clearly technology is going to be the driver against any future changes to PACE. So I'm asking you to predict the future now.
There'll always be issues around the examination of data storage devices, be they phones or whatever, for the defence. The defence are going to want to know what's on the device in sexual cases. They may have to be show cause for wanting that, for example. But I can think of, once a way of showing cause is found, everybody will use the same way of showing cause. There'll be practical problems in equality of arms and allowing a fair defence if we say that we're not going to examine fully the data, or we're not going to allow the defence on a proper request access to the data. I think that would be a problem for us.
I think the reason for PACE now is different to the reason of why it was introduced, because we live in a society now with technology where you can, you know, with artificial intelligence or augmented reality, whatever it is you call it, you know, you can mix computer imagery with real imagery. The bottom line is people don't know what to believe and people don't know what the truth is, and we're in this kind of stalemate situation now. So I think PACE now is just more of to show that the chronology and the providence of evidence rather than the procedures of it, just to show that it is genuine. And of course, time spent recording information, how and why and you got it, there's more time spent on that than there is actually on the actual investigation.
I see steps to reduce, or suggestions to reduce, the level of authority for certain things in surveillance, for example. For me, those need to be kept high where they are, because certainly, again, the digital thing that's changed, the amount that we can intrude into somebody's life on the basis they're a suspect is incredible. The amount of personal data that you can get from somebody without even surveilling them is phenomenal. And under the right circumstances, all those doors are opened up to us, but the authority's high, and I think that has to remain high.
There's going to be all sorts of things in the future, isn't there, about access to evidence. You're going to have body-worn technology, subdermal technology, accessing that, tracking data, and it's not something we can even perceive now. I get your point, Dave, and it's a very good point that the technology can change, but the way we gather the evidence and the more strategic side of it about how we gather and present and exhibit and fairness in which that is gathered remains the same under Pace.
Well, it's a bit of a dry subject, even drier than Steve's jokes, but it is a crucial part of policing.
The Thin Blue Mind with Bradshaw, Horton and Thomas. Policing insights and opinion.
Well, that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. This podcast is in partnership with Policing TV, the leading policing media channel. So until the next time, on the next podcast, take care.